The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post, Religion News Service, NPR, and the Associated Press. First of all, we have an article from the Washington Post, published on September the 14th, 2022, entitled, Nation's Largest Interdenominational Seminary Picks First Black President, by Yanat Shimran. Fuller Theological Seminary, the largest interdenominational seminary in the United States, has chosen as its new president David Emanuel Goatley, who will become the first black person to hold the office. Goatley, 61, will replace Mark Laberton, who announced he was stepping down last year after 10 years as president. Goatley, who will take the helm in January, comes to Fuller from Duke Divinity School, where he was hired in 2018 to direct the Office of Black Church Studies and teach theology. He has since also become Associate Dean for Academic and Vocational Formation. Fuller, founded in Pasadena, California in 1947 by the radio evangelist Charles E. Fuller, offers master's and doctoral degree programs across its two schools, the School of Mission and Theology and the School of Psychology and Marriage and Family Therapy. It enrolled 2,458 students in 2021-22, slightly down from its 2,788 in 2018-19. The seminary is seen as more progressive than some of its evangelical counterparts. School officials have allowed an LGBTQ student group on campus, for instance, even as they have maintained a traditional sex ethic in its code of conduct. Laberton, who has been president of Fuller since 2013 after serving as pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Berkeley, has said he hoped his successor would be a woman and or a person of color. Santiago Jimmy Mulatto, who is the CEO of Compassion International, who chaired Fuller's presidential search team, said Goatley was uniquely prepared to further the seminary's mission. A native of Louisville, Goatley is ordained in the National Baptist Convention. He earned a PhD at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and is best known for his theological study of mission work. For more than two decades, he served as CEO of Lot Carey Baptist Foreign Mission Society, a black mission society stepping down in 2018. Blessed with extraordinary collection of life experiences, healthy drive, innovative spirit, relevant capabilities, all seasoned with wisdom, he brings a track record of building up diverse leaders for Jesus across the globe, Mulatto said. Goatley acknowledged the strain on Christian theological education at a time when enrollments are declining, churches are closing, and Christians are shrinking as a share of the U.S. population. In 2019, Fuller closed campuses in Orange County, Northern California, and the state of Washington, but the seminary retains its campuses in Pasadena, Phoenix, and Houston. These are tough times for institutions to serve the church, Goatley said. But we've been through tough times before. We won't shrink from the challenge. Goatley also cited the cost and accessibility of theological education, as well as what he called the toxicity of the culture, among the challenges he will face in guiding the seminary. He said he was drawn to Fuller because of its commitment to ministerial and vocational formation, its willingness to work in residential, remote, and hybrid education, and what he called its commitment to the world. That resonates with me and who I am and where I find energy, Goatley said. The next article is from the Religion News Service, and it was published on September the 20th, 2022, entitled California Legalizes Human Composting Bill Against Opposition by Catholic Bishops, by Alejandra Molina. The process of converting bodies into soil is now legal in California after Governor Gavin Newsom on September the 18th signed a bill that will allow human composting in the Golden State. Burial, cremation, and alkaline hydrolysis have been the only death care choices available in California. Beginning in 2027, human composting, or natural organic reduction, will be another option for individuals who want a different method to honor their remains after death. The process for composting a body was introduced by the Seattle-based company Recompose, which is now open for business after the state of Washington legalized the process in 2019. Colorado was the second state to legalize it, followed by Oregon and Vermont. It's seen as a more sustainable alternative to cremation, which requires fossil fuels and releases carbon dioxide. In the human composting method, a body is placed in a reusable vessel covered with wood chips and aerated, which creates an environment for microbes and essential bacteria. The body, over a span of about 30 days, is fully transformed into soil. In California, where the massive number of COVID-19 deaths inundated funeral homes and even led to Los Angeles County's suspension of air quality regulations on cremation, State Assemblywoman Christina Garcia, a Democrat who introduced the legislation, said this was another sad reminder of the need to offer a more environmentally friendly option. Garcia has sought to pass the bill for the last 3 years. I look forward to continuing my legacy to fight for clean air by using my reduced remains to plant a tree, Garcia said. Catholic bishops have opposed this process in states where human composting has been legalized. Kathleen Domingo, executive director for the California Catholic Conference, said the process reduces the human body to simply a disposable commodity. The California Catholic Conference, in June, submitted a letter of opposition in reaction to the bill. In the letter, Domingo likened natural organic reduction to methods of disposal of livestock, not as a means of human burial. Using this method, Domingo said, can create an unfortunate spiritual, emotional, and psychological distancing from the deceased. In New York, where a similar bill awaits the governor's signature, the New York State Catholic Conference, in a statement, said composting human remains is inappropriate. While not everyone shares the same beliefs with regard to the reverent and respectful treatment of human remains, we believe there are a great many New Yorkers who would be uncomfortable at best with this proposed composting fertilizing method, which is more appropriate for vegetable trimmings and eggshells than for human bodies, it said. Death care specialists say this new and environmentally friendly procedure is crucial as cemeteries fill up and people seek more sustainable practices. Under the California bill, the soil created by the human composting method could be used on private land with permission and would be subject to the same restrictions as scattering cremated remains in the state, according to the LA Times. It also prohibits human remains from being commingled with those of another, unless they are family. Now an article from the National Public Radio, which was published on September the 2nd, 2022, that is entitled, Jehovah's Witnesses Resume Door-to-Door Visits for the First Time Since the Pandemic, written by the Associated Press. Jehovah's Witnesses have restarted their door-to-door ministry after more than 2.5 years on hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic, reviving a religious practice that the faith considers crucial and cherished. From coast to coast, members of the Christian denomination fanned out in cities and towns on September 1st to share literature and converse about God for the first time since March 2020. In the Jamaica Plain neighborhood on the south side of Boston, Dan and Carrie Sedaris spent a balmy morning walking around knocking on doors and ringing bells. Dan Sedaris said he had been apprehensive about evangelizing in person in a changed world, but the experience erased any traces of doubt. It all came back quite naturally because we don't have a canned speech, he said. We try to engage with people about what's in their hearts, and what we say comes from our hearts. The couple was surprised at how many people opened their doors and were receptive. One man took a break from a Zoom call to accept their booklets and set up an appointment to continue the conversation. At another home, a woman spoke of how many family members died in the last 2 years, something the Sedarises could relate to, both of them having lost parents recently. Another woman was too busy at the moment, but spoke to Carrie through the window and said she could come back Sunday. I've been looking forward to this day, she said. When I rang the first doorbell this morning, a total calm came over me. I was back where I needed to be. Jehovah's Witnesses suspended door knocking in the early days of the pandemic's onset, just as much of the rest of the society went into lockdown, too. The organization also ended all public meetings at its 13,000 congregations nationwide and canceled 5,600 annual gatherings worldwide, an unprecedented move not taken even during the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, which killed 50 million people. Witnesses continued their ministry by writing letters and making phone calls, but it wasn't the same because it lacked a personal touch, said Robert Hendricks, national spokesperson for the denomination. To us, going door to door is an expression of our God's impartiality, he said. We go to everyone and let them choose whether they want to hear us or not. Even in pre-pandemic times, door-knocking ministry came with anxiety because witnesses never knew how they would be received at any given home. In 2022, that's even more the case, and evangelizers are being advised to be mindful that lives and attitudes have changed. Hendricks said, it's going to take an additional level of courage. The organization is not mandating masks or social distancing, leaving those decisions to each individual. The denomination has cautiously been rebooting other activities. In April, it reopened congregations for in-person gatherings, and in June, it resumed public ministry where members set up carts in locations such as subway stations and hand out literature. But getting back to door knocking, considered not just a core belief but also an effective ministry, is a big step forward toward a return to normal, Hendricks said. Among those eager to pound the pavement again was Jonathan Gomas of Milwaukee, who started door knocking with his parents when he was big enough to ring a doorbell. When you're out in the community, you have your hand on the pulse, he said. We haven't had that close feeling with the community for more than 2 years. It feels like we've all become distant and polarized. Gomas and his wife and two daughters have all learned Hmong in order to better reach out to members of that community, and residents are often pleasantly surprised to open their doors to fluent speakers of their language. I think it made them listen even closer, he said. In Agworth, Georgia, Nathan Rivera said he is greatly missed seeing people's faces and reading their expressions. You see and appreciate these responses, and it's much more personal, he said. You establish common ground, and relationships that you can never develop over the phone or by writing a letter. The son of Cuban refugees who came to the United States in the 1980s, Rivera said door knocking is an important part of his spiritual identity and feels Christ-like. "We show respect for each person's right to hold a different belief," he said. "If they don't want to hear what we have to say, we politely thank them and move on, recognizing that we cannot judge anyone. We'll just keep on knocking." Next is a piece from the Religion News Service, published on the 19th of September, 2022, and entitled, "New Museum Exhibit Seeks to Show Samaritans Are More Than a Biblical Parable," by Menachem Wecker. Growing up, when Stephen Fine learned about the Qum, the Samaritans, in the Talmud, the references went in this ear and out the other. In 1977, he met a Samaritan for the first time at one of the salons. The late Jewish folklorist and Hebrew University professor Dov Noy hosted. But he didn't just meet any Samaritan that day. Benny Sedeka, who remains a friend, was the son of the community's leader. Suddenly, that biblical people, best known for the protagonist in Jesus' famous parable of the Good Samaritan, became real to Fine, a college sophomore. Now a professor of Jewish history at Yeshiva University, Fine still has that biblical people on the brain, and Samaritans are having something of a cultural moment. Fine co-curated the exhibit, The Samaritans, a Biblical People, which opened on September 16th at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, and edited a new scholarly volume of the same title. He was academic advisor to the first ever Samaritan cookbook in 2020, and to a new documentary about Samaritans by filmmaker Moshe Alafi. Also in 2022, the superhero film Samaritan, starring Sylvester Stallone, ostensibly pits the good guy Samaritan against evil brother Nemesis. The film takes for granted that viewers recognize the reference from Luke's gospel. In his parable, Jesus tells of a certain Samaritan who tends to the wounds of a man whom bandits had left for dead. Though a priest and Levite pass the victim, the Samaritan loads him on his animal, takes him to an inn, and settles with the innkeeper. "Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?" Jesus asked. Today, every state in America has a version of a Good Samaritan law, shielding those who provide emergency treatment from most malpractice suits. In an unlikely turn of fate, Zeely Charney, the widow of Leon Charney, who was instrumental in creating New York's Good Samaritan law, has supported many of Fine Samaritan projects. Jeffrey Kloa, chief curatorial officer at the Bible Museum, cites the Seinfeld episode in which the main characters are arrested under a Good Samaritan law for not helping someone in need. The character Kramer explains, "The Samaritans were an ancient tribe, very helpful to people." Kloa laughs off the latter clause, but corrects the tense of the former. The Samaritans are not a relic of the past, but a living people. That is the main lesson Fine and exhibit co-curator Jesse Abelman, the museum's Hebraica and Judaica curator, hope visitors will take away from the show. In an interview at the Bible Museum, which mostly transpired in Hebrew, with a translator present, Yefet Sedaka, whose brother Fine met in 1977, said the Samaritan community is pleased with the exhibit, with which it was very involved. "There are currently 862 Samaritans, up from 145 in 1917, according to Sedaka. Most live either in the West Bank on Mount Gerizim, which is sacred to the people in the city of Holon, just outside of Tel Aviv. Samaritans are not Jews, but our people, Am Yisrael, the Israelite people. Each Samaritan, Tzedakah said, can trace back to which tribe, Ephraim, Manasseh, or Levi, from which he comes. Samaritans have lived in the Holy Land since biblical times, according to Tzedakah, who once told former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, "You are a guest of ours." Despite Samaritan longevity in Israel, the community has faced a gender imbalance at times, with 5 men to every 2 women, according to Tzedakah. In a controversial move, his grandfather married a woman from outside of the community, which the then high priest endorsed. She converted and, in part due to her dogged nature, became accepted in the community. In recent years, Samaritan men have married Ukrainian women who moved to Israel, convert, and join the community. Asked whether the war in Ukraine has impacted such matches, Tzedakah said the community is poised to face a different challenge. Having so zealously brought in outside women, Samaritans may have significantly more women than men within a decade or two. It is much more problematic from the community's perspective for outside men to join. "That will be for the high priest to resolve," said Tzedakah. The Museum of the Bible exhibit, which includes artifacts spanning from the 2nd century before the Common Era to contemporary paintings made in the past couple of years, notes that Samaritans, who are mentioned in both Jewish and Islamic texts, have often clashed with both. One wall text tells of a 16th century Huguenot Hebraist, Joseph Scaliger, who requested texts from an Egyptian Samaritan community, only to have those texts lost in a shipwreck. They were recovered, sparking further Christian interest in Samaritans. Another vitrine contains the custom typewriter that Rabbi Moses Gaster, who lived from 1856 to 1913, used to correspond with Samaritans living in Nablus at the base of Mount Gerizim. When he typed in Jewish Hebrew letters, the text was printed in Samaritan Hebrew letters. His pen pal, Jacob, son of Aaron, the high priest, saw an opportunity to harness Gaster's academic platform and reputation to amplify Samaritan culture. The show highlights many Samaritan religious practices, which often resemble Jewish ones. Samaritans sacrifice lambs annually, drawing many outside spectators. It is the only monotheistic group that still sacrifices animals, according to the documentary. On the Sukkot holiday, Samaritans build ritual huts. Whereas Jews typically build theirs outside and avoid anything overhanging the top of the sukkah, Samaritans make them indoors and decorate them with fresh fruit. Samaritan sukkah on display at the Museum of the Bible had plastic fruit, some of which the curators had purchased from Hobby Lobby. Samaritans keep the Sabbath and ritual purity laws strictly, and they too hold the Torah sacred. But Samaritan and Jewish scripture are not the same, and Samaritan religious leaders have ruled very differently than rabbis have on ritual matters over the centuries. Most dramatically, Samaritans hold sacred the Mount Gerizim, where the Samaritan high priest lives, whereas Jews have a different temple mount. Fine said the Samaritans are a micro people and have had a real chance of disappearing. "They fit on 2 747s, he said. He hopes the exhibit will humanize Samaritans. "The truth is, there are good Samaritans, there are bad Samaritans, there are average Samaritans, there are smart Samaritans, there are less smart Samaritans," he said. "I like the people I study, and I want to give them a voice," he added. Across the National Mall from the Museum of the Bible, the Good Samaritan makes an unlikely appearance at the National Gallery of Art. The exhibit, The Double, Identity and Difference in Art Since 1900, does not reference Samaritans, but independent scholar Hillel Schwartz's essay in the exhibit catalog is all about Samaritans, whom he describes as an Israelite double. In biblical times, Samaritans were next-door neighbors to Judeans, but not kissing cousins, he writes. Schwartz, who is working on a book about emergency that will address the Good Samaritan, said sermons centering on the parable increased in the mid-18th century, when emergencies were first thought about in an institutionalized way in the West. In the current projects on Samaritans, Schwartz doesn't see new archaeological or textual findings, and he thinks the Samaritan community has a long history of supporting projects that present it in a positive light. But he said, it's no coincidence that there's once again increased attention on Samaritans, noting new research on altruism that pushes back against social Darwinist and neoliberal tendencies to view the world as every man for himself. The fact that you would have more interest in Good Samaritans is significant in that cultural historical moment, he said. It is one of the current paths toward projecting optimism into the future. In a recent talk to a church group, Fine noted that the Good Samaritan is the guy who does not avert his eyes when someone is in need. Everyone wants to believe they do as he did, but, Fine told the group, everyone present would likely act not like the Samaritan, but as the priest and the Levite did, and avert their gaze. Who has been on the subway and hasn't, he said. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.